Accession number 28495, reel number 5.
Oh, Hughes, reel 5. Can you tell me about the first solo you did with the Tiger Moth?
Yes. I'd already made several takeoffs with the instructor in charge. He was there with me. I'd already made 7 hours flying, and we're probably only doing about half an hour at a time. There's no point in doing longer. So it was almost automatic. I didn't have to think about it to any great degree, and the instructor didn't have to give me instructions or touch the controls. The communication between us, of course, is by tube, speaking tube, from one to the other. My ears to his mouth and his mouth to my ears. You know the thing, I've got some sort of the bits.
Is it a Gosport tube?
Gosport tube, yeah. So the thing that I remember is that the circuit went quite smoothly. It's at 1,000 feet. And when I turned into land, there were two aircraft on my right, my starboard, and the field was not completely available because part of it was being reseeded, and there's a barrier to prevent you going onto that port. So I realised that I was going to be in a small landing strip with two aircraft close to me. And I thought the sensible thing to do was simply open up the throttle and fly around again, which I did. And then on my second approach, I was the only one on the landing strip approach. It seemed to be a normal landing. And the instructor, when I taxied into him, said he approved of that action. I did the right thing. Even if I might have been able to get in, it was a bit of a squeeze. There's no point in risking it.
So at that stage, it sounds like it had been a very basic training with the Tiger Moth that you received at that stage. You hadn't done any kind of aerobatics or
spinning? No, we did no aerobatics. And I didn't do any aerobatics, but the instructor did maybe one loop or two loops. But they knew they couldn't go beyond that in case the last thing they wanted was to have a pupil with them being sick.
So at that stage, once you'd soloed, obviously you said you went to Heaton Park and it was read out that you were going to be a pilot.
Yes.
How did you feel at that stage?
Oh, over the moon. Oh, I was delighted. It's impossible to say, of course. And the man who was my close friend at the time, sitting next to me, John Cottier, became a navigator. He was disappointed, but that was life. I can't remember the proportion of pilots to navigators, but it must have been close to 50-50. There might have been more pilots than navigators because there were a certain number of aircraft single seat. But on the other hand, the majority of the aircraft would be twin engine, four engine bombers, requiring a crew, requiring a navigator and a pilot. And they, of course, many of the people for navigation would have gone to Canada or South Africa for training, as did most of the pilots.
And moving to Heaton Park, was that at that stage, was that just a holding centre?
It was only a holding centre. Very little opportunity for training. They tried what they could to let us train, and there was a swimming pool at Heaton Park, completely surrounded by trees and chalets along each side for getting changed in. But because of the trees and the pool not being maintained, no sensible person would swim in it now, but we did. And you were swimming, you dive down and swim, and you could see all these weeds dangling down. I don't think it was particularly healthy, but they didn't stop us. They encouraged us. It was a really shocking place to swim.
How long were you waiting at Heaton Park?
Oh. Through some of May and into June.
Was it?
Sorry. In June and July. And because of the waiting, there was a certain amount of discontent. And this began to show itself in sayings like Joe for King, Joe being, of course, Stalin, and Tonda Leo for Queen. I only discovered a month or two ago who Tonda Leo was. Tonda Leo was played by a glamorous actress, Hedy Lamarr, the most beautiful girl in the world at that time, probably a good reason. She was, I think, from somewhere like Czechoslovakia and had been in films there and had been married to a man who was something like a physicist or scientist. Do you know this story? And so she is credited with having invented and patented a method of communication, which meant that the transmitter station would periodically change frequency, synchronized to the receiver. And by doing this rapid change, it was very difficult to eavesdrop. And apparently they were using tape. Well, nowadays, doing that electronically must be so simple. Everybody must be doing it. But she said she patented this and handed it over to the military, and she never got any credit for it, but she thinks they used it. You know the story.
But she played somebody called Tonda Leo? Hmm? She played somebody called Tonda Leo?
Oh, no. The part Tonda Leo was an African queen, and she played that part.
Was the frustration born out of the length of time it was taking you to train?
Sorry?
Was the frustration born out really because of the length of time it was taking to train?
The fact that we were hanging around in this place, we weren't being kept busy, and, you know, idle hands, you know what they do. They did their best. They gave us lectures. They gave us a reasonable amount of time off and so on. But you always got the drill instructor or sergeant who, you know, wanted to throw his weight about. I've no personal experience, but I'm inclined to believe this story. One drill sergeant got so uppity they couldn't stand him any longer, so they threw him in the pond, in the lake, a big lake, and it's cold, it was winter. And when he came to the side, they threw him in again, and they said, "You're going to stay in there until you've had enough, and until you've forgotten our faces." So they let him out, and he was moved next day.
How did that period come to an end?
We were just told that we were going to go abroad, and we were given the usual embarkation leave, just to go back and see the family or something like a fortnight. And then we had to report back when we were told that we were going to join a ship at Liverpool, the Andes, which was going to take us over to Canada to, Moncton? I've forgotten the name of the port. Halifax. We went to Halifax on the Pasteur, which was a French ship which had been commandeered. It had French toilets. Shall I describe them? Imagine a room on the ship, below waterline, about the length of this room. Imagine two troughs, steel, semi-cylindrical troughs, the full length, wooden scaffolding for the seats above, so you could approach from either side. It would handle an enormous number of people. And when the ship was steaming, the water was rushing down these troughs. And you would climb up there and perform, making sure that fountain pens and things didn't go up there, because anything dropped had gone instantly. It was the most interesting thing, and I studied this and I thought, if we could time the speed, we could probably work out the ship's speed. So all we required was somebody to sit at the entrance and drop something in and somebody time it. Unfortunately, we didn't get a stopwatch, and they seemed to keep us busy anyway. So I never got around to doing this, but I did think up a name. Have you read Winnie the Pooh? The name for this game, of course, was Pooh Sticks.
Sorry, I didn't get to try it.
What were the other conditions like on board? What was food and sleeping?
It was reasonable. We were crowded, but we were put into working parties. I was lucky. I was put into a working party whose job was to transfer food from the big refrigeration units into the kitchens. And when they opened these bigger refrigeration units and chilled rooms, it was like Aladdin's cave. Fruit, bananas, and you name it. Which meant that we all were permitted to help ourselves to one or two little tidbits. That helped quite a bit. And also, we were carrying quite a fair number of Germans, prisoners, who occasionally put their face up out of down below and see what was going on. They weren't locked in, but they were watched, and so there was no problem with them. And the Pastor, being a fast ship, she steamed alone, unescorted, so it was a pretty uneventful voyage.
What happened when you arrived in Halifax?
Halifax, well, we were quickly off the train to Moncton, which was the huge reception dispersal unit, and it was servicing all the aircrew, pilots and navigators to wherever they were going in Canada, and in our case, we were going on to Arizona.
At what stage did you realise that you would be going to America?
Not until we got, I think, to Moncton. And we were told then the date of departure, and we were going to go by train from Moncton on Canadian trains to Chicago and then change to the American train. We would be told about that time, not before. So we hadn't really met many of the people that would be on that particular posting at that time. The Canadian trains were extremely interesting. They were burning wood. And they had the typical enormous cow catcher or something for catching the dust. But you could open the windows. Everything was gritty and muddy, dusty, and the smoke everywhere. So you got accustomed to this. It was warm, but there were a few blankets, and there was just hinged down shelf would sleep to and get sleep some on the trains there. At Chicago, changing trains onto the American train, it was coal burning, but it was up to the standard of many of our good trains now. I'm sure it was probably double glazed. It was silent. It was air conditioned. You couldn't open windows, and it was really luxurious. And the food was marvellous, and because our party had priority, we were always called first for meals. The other people would look at us with envy as we were walking up the coaches for the first sitting every time. And we enjoyed this, and we noticed that as we were going further and further south, it was getting warmer and warmer and warmer, but the temperature in the train stayed constant. And this was a fascinating journey because we went right through the middle places like Kansas, and then going down through where New Mexico would it be, and then places like El Paso, Tucson, Arizona, and then finally at Mesa, a small sort of township about 25 miles outside Phoenix, Arizona. And our camp was about 4 miles outside Mesa.
How many people had been posted with you to that? What was the size of the group?
The number would be of the order of 75, with 25 Americans to make up around 100. They joined us when we got there. The Americans, they wouldn't admit it, nobody would admit it at the time, but they were obviously hand-picked. It was an experiment which had been started a little earlier. They thought it was a good idea to put some Americans onto these courses for training with the British, but they're not going to put anybody on, were they? These Americans all had a minimum of 2 years' experience, and This book is the full story of the RAF in Arizona. It lists every course, every single course, every man trained and what he did. It's a wonderful, wonderful reference book.
That's the RAF in Arizona, Falcon Field, 1945 by Jim Dawson.
Yeah. And it's in this that they admit this selection of these people. So when they came to the final exams and the passing out, the Americans were always well up. And we were working hard if we were anywhere near them.
So how was the organisation of the field then? Who was in charge and who ran operations?
Yes. Well, there's a wing commander in charge with a number of RAF officers, both for training in theory and a few as check pilots. But essentially, the whole field was run by civilians, by Southwest Airways. All the instructors were civilians. The senior instructors who did check flying as well were civilians. And they were supported by one or two RAF officers to just check on their standards. Much of the lecturing was carried out by RAF people as well. Discipline, I can't remember now. We didn't do much by way of marching and so on. There's hardly any of that, so we don't think we had any drill instructors. There were three courses there at any one time. There was the primary, there was the advanced first and the advanced second. So that would mean approaching 300 pilots. Of course, the numbers would reduce as pilots would fail and be sent off to become, say, navigators or whatever. So probably at the end of a course, you might typically finish with, say, 75 to 80 finishing the course. Perhaps a little bit better than that, but certainly the reasonable number would be failed at an earlier stage.
And would they then remuster?
They would automatically go to be navigators. It's unlikely that they would go to be, shall we say, wireless operators or the gunners. The quality to be the navigator, it was the next best option. One of my friends who didn't make it as a pilot there went from Arizona to train as a navigator in Canada, and I have somewhere can't see if I thought I brought it in. TV, but also a complete film was made at Arizona with Gene Tierney and another famous actor, E.G. Robinson. And they made this film, 20th Century Fox, and they paid us by building us a swimming pool, which isn't.
With somebody who would fail the course at that stage, would they have to leave quickly from the course?
Immediately, yeah, the sooner the better.
What's the reasoning behind that?
Well, you didn't want a man sitting around doing nothing, idle, and chatting to his friends and generally getting fed up. It's better for his sake. It wouldn't affect the others. You see, as soon as someone has been told he's going to leave as navigator, he's gone. He's not in your gang anymore, is he? And so you're sympathetic, but he's now mentally he's written off, and he's not going to be there the next day.
How did the pattern of training start there?
Well, we started with the training on the Harvard, an advanced trainer, which is very advanced. You see, from the Tiger Moth, we were going from about 120 horsepower to about... steerman, first of all. The steerman was a biplane, radial engine, with about
200, 300 horsepower. Much more powerful thing.
Did it differ much from the Tiger Moth?
Quite considerably in sheer size and power and weight. And the things it could do, it's much stronger. Pretty much the same amount, slightly more instrumentation than the Tiger Moth. It's used by Utterly Butterly. You know that those people, don't you? They're still using those Tiger Moths. They're still using the Stearman. We found it fairly easy to fly, a little bit more difficult to fly than the Tiger Moth. And because it had a narrow undercarriage, it had a tendency to ground loop. In other words, it used to spin and touch the floor. It wasn't serious, but it was an offence. Fortunately, I managed not to do it, but a few people did. So you really had to learn to fly the thing. Well, the pattern of instruction, which is pasted in the beginning of the logbook, it starts with the flying training requirements, obviously starting with the easy methods, and gradually becoming more difficult. Introduction, effects of controls, straight and level flight, climbing and descending, taxiing. Shall I continue this? All how much?
As much as in the early part.
Medium turns, further effects of controls, stalling, climbing and gliding turns, taking off into wind, circuits, approach and landing, going around again, 14 spinning. That comes in at quite an early stage. So you do all of those 14 exercises before the first solo.
OK, if we can take those back there from some of those things. Obviously, some of those things you've done with the Tiger Moth.
That's right, yeah.
But could you describe to me how you make the aircraft climb and descend? That was one of the things we didn't discuss. So how did you do that, say, in the Stearman?
Well, it's a combination of speed and power. Whatever the cruising speed, you're going to climb at a slightly slower speed. So if you're cruising at, shall we say, 120 miles an hour in this aircraft, and you're going to climb, you increase the power, you bring the nose up by drawing the control column backwards and start climbing at a rate dictated by the power you're applying and the power of the engine, and whether you want to climb sort of rapidly or slowly. Descending, you'd reduce the power, lower the nose so that it's pointing in a downward direction in a gliding mode, and you can maintain, you always must maintain a minimum speed, otherwise you'll stall. And in a descent, you could throttle the engine back until it's just idling and maintain speed by simply putting the nose down more in order to maintain whatever is a safe speed.
What about stalling?
Stalling, obviously something you must learn at a very early age. In the stall, the aircraft is flying at too slow a speed to maintain lift, and the flow of air, smooth flow of air over the wing, suddenly becomes turbulent, and there's a sudden and immediate loss of lift. Usually, it's dictated by vibration in the aircraft. You have some physical warning, but when the aircraft stalls, it immediately falls. It may fall to the left, to the right, or it may fall straight away. The correction is simple. You put the nose down and you open up the throttle to produce speed necessary. It's a simple operation, quickly learned, and necessary to be well aware of the nature of the fall, so that if it does happen when you're not expecting it, you have a reflex reaction, you correct it instantly.
You mentioned there as well taking off into wind. Why do you have to take off into wind?
Normally, you always take off to wind, and all birds do it. Obviously, you've got to reach a certain speed through the wind. Shall we say you can take off at 100 miles an hour? If you've got a 20 mile an hour wind facing you, when you're going at 80 miles an hour over the ground, you've got 100 miles an hour airspeed, you can climb. But if you're rather foolish and you're taking off downwind, you need 100 miles an hour airspeed, but you've got to add to that 20 miles an hour wind speed, so you've got to be going over the ground at 120 miles an hour before you get flying speeds. So it's as simple as that.
And the wind helps with lift, does it?
Yes, because it gives you that extra speed. It's a simple case of that whatever the wind speed is, you reach flying speed that much sooner. Often aircraft carrier, they give you 30 knots of wind, but we'll come to that later.
Can you tell me about spinning? As a non-flyer, can you tell me what spinning's like?
Spinning, in World War One, spinning was a death sentence. They didn't know what to do. And of course, somebody had to find out what you had to do. There are a few aircraft in which spinning is forbidden, and the Corsair is one of them. But all the training aircraft can be spun easily and safely, and you can recover from it. So in practice spinning, the first thing to do is to make sure you've got clear space below you. And you reduce the power, close the throttle, and start to lift up the nose, which will cause it to stall. And when it's about to stall, you'll use left or right rudder to make it fall sideways. And you maintain that rudder. That will immediately put it into a spin. Now, for an aircraft, a spin is a stable condition. It will stay in that condition until you do something about it. And what you have to do about it is to use full opposite rudder, which will reduce the spin and stop you spinning. You've already got the nose down in the spin, but you push the nose down further. So full opposite rudder, nose down further until it's now diving, and then you pull out of that dive using power as required to maintain the necessary airspeed.
Is it an easy thing to do when you first have to do a spin?
It's not too easy. By this time, of course, you should have got past being airsick. If you're still airsick, you're probably in the wrong job. So you're not too worried about airsickness, which also doesn't bother you too much because you're too busy to think about it. The sight of the ground spinning around you at first is a little frightening, but it's surprisingly how quickly you get accustomed to it, especially when you know that you can correct it when the instructor tells you to correct it. After a few times, you then, instead of doing, say, one or two turns, normally you will only do about one or two turns and then correct immediately. But when the instructor feels you're comfortable with it, he'll tell you to do a precision turn. You line up with a feature like a runway, a road or a railway, and you start to spin, and he'll say, do me a five-turn precision spin. So you'll do five turns and do the correction exactly lined up with there. You actually later on will go up and do 20 turns. And by the time you get to do 20 turns, you're very comfortable.